If you've ever consulted a real estate agent, you'll recognize this familiar line.
Something to suit a growing family? Certainly. Here's a desirable residence. 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, all electric kitchen, spacious living, separate dining, basement playroom, central heating, close schools and transportation, garage, for sale or rent.
All you need is cash for the down payment, security, good prospects, and a reasonably stable peace.
I'll take it.
Good for you, lucky man. Of course, other accommodation is available.
Undesirable subdivided barracks. 9 by 15 cubicles, all wool blanket partitions, privacy not guaranteed. Utility furniture, stool, bed, saucepan, kerosene cooker, packing case table. Rent free for married couple, 1 child. Indefinite lease.
Or?
Limestone cave on hillside. Fairly dry, but view superb.
Or?
Scrap timber shanty near highway. Will accommodate several.
Or?
Back street doorstep. Overnight occupancy only.
All you need for these is what you stand up in, as much hope as you can muster, and the usual amount of instability in our time.
United Nations Radio presents Residence Desired. This program is an introduction to an international effort on behalf of human beings, the World Refugee Year. Our narrator is Oscar Homolka.
After 4 or 5 years of intensive study, after searching examinations, comes the reward, a degree, and an obligation.
At the time of being admitted as a member of the medical profession,
I solemnly pledge myself to consecrate my life to the service of humanity.
I will not permit considerations of religion, race, party politics, or social standing to intervene between my duty and my patient.
I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception.
I make these promises solemnly, freely, and upon my honor.
The modern wording of the Hippocratic Oath, the ethical doctrine which the medical profession has followed for more than 2,000 years. But in his work, a doctor knows that such dedication requires an emotional discipline that superficially and at times may look very like indifference. To be moved to anguish by suffering, to be involved in pain, to withdraw from death is to tempt failure. A doctor, therefore, must serve and respect life with a deep and abiding compassion that is, at the same time, detached. So, too, with efforts to lift the weight of misery and frustration from the uprooted millions around the world, the human beings who have been turned by events into statistics, it is impossible to be unmoved by their plight or not to feel a profound and genuine sympathy and the desire to do something. But these reactions to the ugly truth can surge and recede like waves. And if this monumental human tragedy is to have a truly happy ending, they are not enough. They must be sustained. They must be the constant, unvarying motive force behind a deliberate and planned attack on the problem. They must, in short, inspire the same compassionate detachment as the doctors. That is why this program will not make its prime appeal to the emotions. The facts by themselves speak with a clear and compelling voice. It is 1957. A plane is landing at London Airport. Among the passengers are three Englishmen. Their names? Christopher Chataway, Colin Jones, and Trevor Philpott. They've been touring Europe, the Middle East, the Far East. Back in London, they plan to write an article about their travels for a magazine, but it will not be a travel article full of the usual glossy observations about faraway places. It will contain passages like these.
Any traveler nowadays knows this living tragedy eye to eye. They stare through the barriers of Hong Kong Airport.
The refugees from China.
They stare from the roadside, through the dust clouds thrown up by the buses, on their way into Karachi or Delhi.
The refugees from the partition of the Indian subcontinent.
They stare from the black caves, into the white sunlight that burns the hillsides of the Holy Land.
Arab refugees from Palestine.
At nightfall in the station yard at Searle, the wolf eyes of the orphan children gleam in the dark, searching, hungry and pitiless, for profit.
The legacy of the Korean War.
In Jericho, the living still go out secretly, in the dark, to bury their dead, so that they may not lose their inheritance, the ration card issued by the United Nations.
The finished article was published in March 1958. Its title was direct and unambiguous.
Wanted, a World Refugee Year.
And it sparked a reaction which, between its date of publication and today, has evolved into the international effort which will not be relaxed until July of next year. But before we trace this evolution and outline the methods and objectives of the year, let's look at the shape and size of the problem it faces. What is a million or a billion? We live in an age when numbers frequently float far beyond the boundaries of ordinary common comprehension. Defense budgets are blandly calculated in billions. This project will cost X millions. That project, Y. Trade is up or down to the tune of millions, and so on. You reach the stage when it becomes almost pointless to quote any figures about anything. Nevertheless, we are going to quote some here and now. For one excellent reason. They are not astronomical, but then we are not dealing with the cost of ballistic missiles. At the same time, they are quite large enough, and they happen to refer to human beings.
Between 30 and 40 million.
That roughly is the world total for refugees since the end of World War II. It can be subdivided.
11 million.
In Europe.
12 million.
In India and Pakistan.
5 million.
In Korea.
2 million.
In Formosa.
1 million.
In Vietnam.
Just over a million.
From Palestine.
180,000.
In Morocco and Tunisia. These are not all the figures, nor are they, as of now, the figures in every refugee situation. A fact, at the same time disturbing and encouraging, is that no refugee situation is ever completely static. While new crises can uproot new thousands, there is also evidence, as we shall see presently, that in many situations great improvements have been recorded in recent years. But the refugee problem is not simply one of numbers. The governments, the international agencies, and the private organizations dealing with it have to be concerned not only with the size of the problem, but with its legal aspects. There is, for example, the question of into which category a particular group of refugees must be placed. This may sound unnecessarily impersonal, and certainly the refugee himself, wanting only to cease being one, can hardly be expected to worry very much about it. But it has been necessary to define categories in order to allocate responsibility and to organize help effectively. Broadly speaking, there are two categories. One called national refugees, contains by far the majority of the 30 or 40 million refugees since the last war. For just one illustration, but certainly the most massive, we recall the year 1947.
In that year, many of us who live in the subcontinent of India found ourselves on the wrong side of newly drawn boundaries. That was the year of partition, when the new state of Pakistan came into being. As a result, some 7 million Hindus and Sikhs in Pakistan set out across the border for India, and a countertide of more than 4 million Muslims left India for Pakistan. It was a terrible period, marked often by violence.
These millions were national refugees. The governments of India and Pakistan assumed responsibility for them, and by truly heroic efforts, in the years which followed, they have managed to resettle nearly all of them. The second category contains those refugees for whom the international community has assumed responsibility. Those who find themselves outside their countries of origin and who are unable or unwilling to return to it. To protect and help them, there has been international action since the end of the First World War. But we'll confine ourselves to the two organs of the United Nations at work at the present time. The Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees and the Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees. Take UNRWA, the agency for the Arab refugees first. Here is Mr. Thomas Jameson, Assistant Director of UNRWA's Department of Operations in Beirut.
UNRWA's mandate is to look after the people until such time as a political solution is found. And therefore we are really trying to help the people to prepare themselves for a new life, either at home, if they're repatriated, or by going to some new country, or by trying to settle down in the countries where they now are. To achieve this, they require to be fed, they require to be housed, they require medical attention, and we have to have an education program.
To the absolute limit of its always limited resources, UNRWA has been doing all this for 10 years. But the final solution of the problem remains elusive. The end is not in sight. Dr. Elfin Rees of the World Council of Churches, one of the many religious and voluntary organizations cooperating with UNRWA and in other refugee affairs, sums up the situation like this.
We are told by some that there can be no solution of the problem of the Middle East until there is a solution of the refugee problem. We are told by others that there can be no solution of the refugee problem until there is a solution of the problem of the Middle East. That's a matter of politics, and one hopes and prays that the politicians will do their best to find a solution not only to the one but to both problems, and who cares at which end they start. Meanwhile, the refugees are there.
Over 1 million of them.
Every day we give every child or every person referred to this place by the doctor a hot meal. And these meals are especially for the undernourished persons. And they'll be referred to the tables here where you can see that every child or every person here has got his dish in front of him with the hot meal required according to the menu.
In Gaza we have been able to provide concrete block huts with limited space, it is admitted, but nevertheless a great advance on the conditions that were appertaining in 1950 when all the refugees were under canvas. In Gaza, about two-thirds of the refugees exist in these organized camps. Of the remaining third outside the camps, at least 30,000 are Bedouins, always used to the nomadic life, and they are settled down in this area and across the border in the Sinai Desert in their usual form of tented shelter.
For the medical staff, we have 15 doctors and 17 qualified nurses. We have 75 practical nurses, 4 sanitation officers, 3 laboratory technicians, and many workers in our supplementary feeding and sanitation squad. Most of our staff are refugees.
The refugees are pathetic, they are hungry, they are jobless, they are homeless. Sometimes I dream that if they only knew the poetry of A.E. Housman, they might be quoting it to themselves. And how am I to face the odds of man's bedevilment and God's? I, a stranger and afraid, in a world I never made.
Now, take the office of the High Commissioner, with a mandate covering different refugee problems from Europe to North Africa to Hong Kong. Here's the High Commissioner himself, Dr. August Lind.
First of all, we try to give the refugees international protection. A refugee has no consul to turn to. If he gets into difficulties with authorities of the country of residence, he has nobody. And we should be that somebody to look after their interests. And therefore we negotiate with governments on legal conventions that as far as possible the status of the refugee is assimilated to the status of a national. And this international protection will continue until the day when the refugee either decides to return to this country or when he acquires a new nationality. That's one thing. There is a second task, which is to negotiate with governments possibilities of immigration. A great majority of refugees in general would like to emigrate, and rather emigrate far away. And it's therefore necessary for us to see that the country of immigration reserves a considerable percentage of its quota for refugees. The third task is to help a refugee who cannot emigrate or who does not want to emigrate, who does not want to repatriate either, to get on his own feet again in the country where he resides.
By these methods, and with the active cooperation and work of voluntary bodies, many situations have, as we said a while ago, been considerably improved in recent years. When Dr. Lind reported to the UN General Assembly at its last session, he was able to give facts like these.
In 4 years, by means of emigration, voluntary repatriation, and local integration, the problems of 440,000 refugees have been permanently solved.
And the numbers in camps alone have been decreased by 45,000.
But as with UNRWA, so with the High Commissioner, many more problems remain. Old residue problems, as they are sometimes called, including those in which the refugees have been camp-bound or stranded for year after wasteful after demoralizing year. Like the 10,000 Europeans still waiting on the mainland of China or in Hong Kong. For many, visas have been issued for countries of emigration. But there's no money to move them.
Over 17,000 visa assurances have been received in 5 years from over 50 different countries. Every month, an average 100 new assurances are received, which bring hope and pleasure to the recipient. Unfortunately, visas without funds for movement are little more than the proverbial mirage of flowing water seen by a man slowly dying of thirst in the desert. To adapt a phrase once spoken by a famous statesman, give us the tools and we can complete the job.
That was Mr. Kenneth Summer, who in Hong Kong represents the UN High Commissioner and the Intergovernmental Committee for European Migration. And that is the earnest plea of everyone working to move these mountains of human misery. Give us the tools. Wanted a World Refugee Year. In the course of the article, the three authors wrote these words.
Ideally, the whole proposition should be put before the General Assembly of the United Nations.
That was in March last year. By December, enthusiasm for the whole proposition had spread from the readers of the article throughout a wide segment of the British population and far beyond Britain. On December 5th, it was put before the General Assembly. The resolution formally laid down the aims of the refugee year.
To focus interest on the refugee problem and to encourage additional financial contributions from governments, voluntary agencies, and the general public.
And
to encourage additional opportunities for permanent refugee solutions through voluntary repatriation, resettlement, or integration on a purely humanitarian basis and in accordance with the freely expressed wishes of the refugees themselves.
The resolution was adopted by a majority of 59. At the national and regional levels, enthusiasm for the idea began to crystallize in active planning.
National committees for refugee year formed in Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, Costa Rica, Denmark, France, Greece, Israel, Italy.
Intergovernmental Committee for European Migration plans to move 50,000 in 1959 program.
Legislative bodies of Council of Europe to be asked for more relief funds and to increase their acceptance of refugees for resettlement.
United States contributes $150,000 to High Commissioner's Office for relief of Algerian refugees.
These were some of the early announcements of action. More have been listed since. Direct and practical steps to turn refugee hopes into realities have been suggested. Governments, for instance, might agree to accept groups of refugees not normally eligible under the immigration laws. Age limits, which now often block the refugees' efforts to emigrate, might be raised. And the refugee families at present considered too large to qualify for immigration might also be admitted. So, too, those whose skills do not, for one reason or another, meet governmental requirements. And there are always those with physical handicaps which have kept them in the deep freeze of enforced idleness. Ways are not lacking. The means too frequently are. And the role of the UN in all this?
Throughout the refugee year, the High Commissioner's Office in Geneva and UNRWA in the Middle East will carry on with the same devotion and energy as ever. But the General Assembly's resolution last December asked for an additional effort to help in the promotion of the year. As a result, a small special secretariat is now at work in the Palace of Nations at Geneva. Heading it, as the Secretary General's special representative, is Mr. Claude de Camilleria.
Our role is to be a center of coordination to keep all the countries participating in the World Refugee Year informed of, first, the problem of the refugees, their needs, and second, what are the plans of the different countries or the national committees set up in these countries for their participation in the World Refugee Year.
I understand. We're not, in fact, starting a new organization floating funds or raising money directly for the WRI.
No, because there is no special fund for it. Every country, every voluntary organization, every national committee will be free to set up its own targets and have its own program for the categories of refugees you wish to help. There is no central fund for it.
And on the whole great concept of the year and on its capacity for success, Mr. de Camilleria added this.
We all know that a one-year effort cannot possibly solve all refugee problems. Yet, a great deal can be done to alleviate human distress and to start positive approaches to the basic issues involved. You see, some problems can be solved entirely, like the camp clearance program of the High Commissioner and of the European refugees in the Far East. As I told you, each country, each group participating in the World Refugee Year can set itself a realistic target and select its own objectives. There will be, I told you, no central fund for the World Refugee Year. Each government, I want to repeat it, each national committee, each private organization is completely free to decide to what use its contribution to the World Refugee Year should be put. The aims of the World Refugee Year, as stated in the General Assembly resolution, is purely humanitarian. I think that the World Refugee Year offers us, both as individuals and as nations, an exceptional opportunity to contribute significantly to the solution of many problems of many refugees and to relieve the distress of others. In seizing this opportunity, we can also help to eliminate an intolerable human waste, for with assistance, refugees can enrich in many ways the communities in which they become productive citizens. It is true that the success of the World Refugee Year will depend on the action of the governments, of the voluntary agencies, of the national committees set up. But through the World Refugee Year, every man, every woman will have the opportunity to remove some of the burden that the plight of the refugees lays upon the conscience of all of us.
A similar thought is expressed in the article which started it all. The three authors wrote,
"A World Refugee Year could yield incomparable dividends in human happiness."
And they wrote this, too.
"There could be no finer way to show that love, as well as fear, still has its victories."
There is an echo there of six other words uttered by a great man many years ago, just after the First World War, when the refugee problem assumed such dimensions that it had to become a matter of international concern. The Norwegian explorer and statesman, Fridtjof Nansen, became the active champion and inspired friend of the homeless. The six words are his. Founded on a life of sacrifice, on devotion, they are words unspoiled by the tones of mere sentiment. In them is the ring of the detachment and the deep and genuine compassion of the doctor. Nansen said, "Love of man is practical policy."
You have been listening to a program introducing the World Refugee Year, June 1959 to July 1960. Its title, Residence Desired. Our narrator, Oscar Homolka. This was a production by the International Staff of United Nations Radio.